Chapter 3. Citizens.
The principal will see you now, my dear, said the receptionist.
Lucy thanked him awkwardly, unsure why the world's surliest front desker was suddenly being nice, especially when she'd been summoned out of her math class. Maybe it was a trick. He probably knew what kind of telling off she was in store for. The principal opened the door and beckoned Lucy inside. The portly woman was wearing her usual teal cardigan and white blouse combo.
Lucy, great to see you. Come on in, said the principal.
Lucy spotted the school counselor sitting by the sofas.
Please take a couch, said the principal, taking one herself.
Lucy sat down on the sofa opposite. The fibers were a little scratchy, but the padding was soft. She shuffled towards one side of the three-seater.
Lucy, I've got some bad news. There's no easy way to say this, but I want you to know we're all here for you, said the counselor.
Lucy looked blankly from the counselor to the principal, both of whom wore the same pitying smiles.
What's going on? Said Lucy.
Your father's been taken to the hospital, said the counselor.
What?
Said Lucy, immediately standing up.
Please sit back down for a moment, Lucy. You'll get to see him shortly, but we need to talk things through first, said the principal.
Lucy sat, but her mind was spinning, already rushing through the route to the hospital, picturing her father in a stretcher, wrapped in plaster after an awful traffic accident.
Your father is sick, Lucy. He's got advanced cancer. It's amazing they've caught it in time. Any longer, and, well, it really is a good thing they found it when they did.
Is he going to die? Said Lucy.
They've got some great doctors working on his treatment plan as we speak, said the counselor.
Lucy, we couldn't get a hold of your mother. Do you know if she's changed her phone number or email? Said the principal.
Lucy stared at her feet.
It's okay if you don't know. I just wanted to check you hadn't heard from her, said the principal.
Not in 2 years, said Lucy, kicking her heels together.
Okay, sweetie. Look, your father's going to be in the hospital for a few days while they run some tests, and he's asked Emily's parents to look after you until he's back.
Emily's parents? Have you met Emily's parents? They're flat earthers. She can't stay with Emily. She'll go insane, protested Dan, leaping up.
Lucy yanked him back down onto the sofa next to her.
Shut up. You'll get us in trouble,
hissed Lucy, blushing and giggling.
I'm saying it how it is. Screw Emily's parents. Come on, said Dan, grabbing Lucy's hand and pulling her from the room.
The receptionist rose to his feet in astonishment as the pair flew by, ignoring his waving clipboard.
Where are we going?
Said Lucy breathlessly as they ran down the school steps into the parking lot, basking in the afternoon sun.
To your mom's,
said Dan, putting on his sunglasses.
You don't even know where she lives,
giggled Lucy as she followed him to their car.
Sure I do,
said Dan, waving a folded letter in his hand. They reached a small Chevy hatchback and Dan pulled the driver's door open and climbed inside. Lucy stopped suddenly.
What is it?
Said Dan, poking his head over the door.
This isn't our car, said Lucy.
Clock's ticking, honey. Don't flake on me now. We need to get the rations to your mom's by nightfall, said Dan.
Lucy felt hot. Her hazmat suit was baking in the sun. Dan slammed the door and reversed.
Wait for me,
she cried, pedaling to no avail as her bike wheels spun out on the slushy carpet of spores. Lucy opened her eyes to find a boot close to her nose. Her cheek was pressed against the truck's corrugated metal floor, which carried the engine's vibrations. Wet fibers pushed against her tongue. She was gagged. Her hands and feet were bound tightly, too. She craned her neck and took in the rest of the truck. Willis and Peters sat on one bench, Brown on another. Lopez was sat on the floor, his back propped up against the foot of the bench. He was similarly bound and gagged, but also had a ripening black eye. He looked balmy.
Look who's up,
said Peters, toasting her with his water bottle. Willis grunted and gave Lucy a cold look. Brown stared into the distance. Lucy wriggled herself towards the wall opposite Lopez
and with difficulty squirmed into an upright position. Her head swam, and the bruise on the back of her skull throbbed painfully. Her arms ached from being pinned behind her back. The truck had an open back, like the carriers she'd been loaded into for the evac train months ago. Behind them was an expanse of snow-covered farmland. Theirs were the only tread marks on the highway. She tried to loosen the bindings around her wrists, but they were solid. She shouted through the gag as best she could, but the soldiers ignored her. So she banged her boots against the metal floor until Peters intervened.
"What?"
he said, pulling the gag down roughly.
"Where are you taking us?"
croaked Lucy, her throat dry.
"Shut your mouth,"
said Peters, moving to replace the gag.
"Wait, I need to pee," said Lucy.
"Then pee," said Peters.
"Water?" cried Lucy.
Peters grabbed his bottle and held it to Lucy's mouth. Water trickled down her chin as the truck jostled, but she got a few precious sips before Peters snatched the bottle away again and jerked her gag back into place. The truck slowed to a halt. Four thumps came through from the driver's cabin.
"If you want to live, you'll both stay quiet. If I hear any noise, I'll kill whoever makes it. We only need one of you to get there alive," said Willis.
He grabbed Lucy by the shoulders and dragged her down to the floor, doing the same to Lopez before covering them both with a blanket. The truck came to a halt. Lucy strained to listen through the stifling polyester. The driver was talking to someone in another truck. The only words she caught from the strangers were "Senator" and "Nightfall." Sergeant Adler replied from their cockpit, and his words sent a chill down Lucy's spine.
"We're transporting two deserters from D.C. for court-martial. They killed one of our men. We rescued this civilian along the way," said Adler. The Canadian greeted the other driver.
"I hope you find the senator, Lieutenant," said Adler.
The two trucks pulled away from one another. Several minutes passed before the blanket was pulled off, and Lucy and Lopez were left to struggle back into their upright positions. Over the next couple of hours, the snowy farmland view gave way to urban sprawl. They crossed two bridges, passing through Staten Island and into Brooklyn, where the truck slowed. They slalomed between burnt-out cars, which had been deliberately arranged to slow any approaching vehicle. Shortly after, the truck came to a stop, and after a moment, the engine cut out. Adler and the Canadian walked around to the rear of the truck.
"Well, we did the flashes, but they're not opening the gate, so I guess they changed the passcode or whatever. We're going through on foot," said Maurice.
Willis and Brown dragged Lucy and Lopez from the truck. Peters cut the ties around their ankles, then marched them to the front of the vehicle. Three buses were parked across the street, wall to wall, blocking the entire way through. As they got closer, it became apparent they were arranged like bricks, with a narrow gap between the overlapping areas.
"Wait here, I'll go announce us. Then you guys come through," said Maurice.
He squeezed between the buses and disappeared.
"Did you miss me?"
he called out from the other side to an unknown audience. His voice echoed off the surrounding buildings.
"Disarm your group, deposit their weapons, then tell them to come through one at a time," ordered the stranger.
Her laconic voice crackled through the megaphone. The Canadian squeezed back through between the buses.
"They want you to hand over your weapons first,"
he said, peering around the gap.
"Yeah, we heard," said Adler.
"You didn't say nothing about disarming,"
said Brown, his nostrils flaring.
"You'll get your weapons back. It's just a precaution,"
insisted Maurice, raking his dark back comb with his fingertips.
"To hell with that,"
said Willis, spitting on the ground, then wiping the residual spittle from his wiry black beard.
"If you don't like it, you can piss off back to whatever shitty little wilderness you came from. I'm sure the facilities are excellent there,"
crackled the megaphone lady. Willis spun around, his rifle raised, his eyes darting across the surrounding buildings.
"If you've got any sense, you'll suck it up, hand over your weapons, and come get a new life."
Her voice was droll, blurring the line between bored and playful.
"Rifles only,"
ordered Adler, concealing his pistol. Peters, Willis, and Brown followed suit before placing the rifles around Maurice's neck, each eyeballing him angrily as they did so. The Canadian slipped back through between the buses, clattering the guns against them as he went,
before loudly and piously depositing them in the open.
"Come through one at a time, with your hands raised,"
ordered Megaphone Lady. "God damn it," said Adler, disappearing between the buses. Peters went next, with one arm chaperoning Lopez behind him. Brown went next and similarly pulled Lucy through. Willis followed close behind. Lucy squeezed around between the buses and emerged onto the other side of the street. The soldiers had their arms raised. Lucy copied Lopez's tactic and turned side on to the building to show that her hands were tied behind her back.
"None of you move,"
ordered the Megaphone Lady. They stood at the end of the street, which formed a T-junction headed up by a large office building backing onto the waterfront. Behind it was the sea, and a bridge leading to Manhattan. Before them was wall-to-wall razor wire. The road to the left was similarly blockaded by trucks and cars. The blockade to the right was further down the street, at the far end of the waterfront building. If this place was anything like her co-working space in San Francisco, there could easily be room for a couple of hundred companies in there. A gaunt young man of around 20 emerged from the front door of the office, clutching an empty cloth bag. He approached the left wall of the street. Between the razor wire and the brick was a metal sheet fixed to the wall. At the base was a jack, which he cranked several times. As the base of the sheet pivoted away from the wall, it pushed the razor wire back, creating a wedge-shaped opening. The skeletal man crawled through the gap in the razor fence and approached Maurice. He patted him down and then moved on to Adler and the rest of the group. He removed each soldier's pistol and grenades, which he placed into the cloth bag. He checked Lucy's backpack and moved on, satisfied it was clean. The man scooped up the four rifles and swung them over his neck, then crawled through the wedge gap and returned to the office building.
"You may enter. Come through the fence nice and slow,"
ordered the Megaphone Lady. Cursing, the soldiers got onto their hands and knees and followed Maurice through the wedge. Lopez hesitated, kneeling, unable to crawl without his arms. Brown reached through and dragged Lopez by the shoulders, then reached in and grabbed Lucy, dragging her through too. It would have shredded her knees were it not for the layer of snow.
"Don't be shy,"
crowed the Megaphone Lady.
"Let me do the speaking, guys. Just trust me. You don't want to say the wrong thing,"
said Maurice as they approached. The building had a spacious, high-ceilinged atrium and a yuppie industrial aesthetic. Redundant filament bulbs dangled in trendy cages, complementing the tastefully rusted metalwork and exposed trunking, which were offset against the dark, polished stone counters. A woman of Lucy's age stood waiting for them. She had light ginger hair, pale skin, hoop earrings, and a face covered in blotchy brown freckles. She was flanked by two guards.
"Marissa! Oh my God, fantastic to see you again,"
said Maurice with a slight squawk. Marissa said nothing and continued chewing her gum while staring at the Canadian.
"I've brought a little gift for the Queen. Two, actually,"
Maurice added nervously, gesturing to Lucy and Lopez.
"We're full," said Marissa.
"She's gonna want to meet these two. Trust me,"
said Maurice.
"I'll bet you my dinner the boss kills him outright,"
said Marissa, turning to a guard who snorted and declined the wager as a fait accompli.
"I'm confident the Queen will welcome these new assets,"
Maurice insisted with a pained smile.
"I guess we'll find out."
"Come on then," said Marissa.
They climbed the window-lit stairwell for several minutes in silence, save for the groups puffing and panting. Lucy's bound hands put a strain on her shoulders and chest, making the climb harder still. The sensation reminded her of the climbs she and Dan had made to their eighth-floor apartment, carrying rations, wearing hazmat suits, moving bodies. As she thought of his face, his voice, his counsel, a knot formed in the pit of her stomach. Lucy arrived at the ninth floor feeling lightheaded. Marissa delivered several knocks on the door in a distinctive pattern. A key turned, and the threshold swung open, revealing a perfectly lit corridor. Bright, recessed ceiling lights shone down on thick emerald carpet and black wooden doors. Music reverberated from one of the furthest apartments. The guard waved Marissa in, then stopped the Canadian.
"Arms out," he ordered.
Is this really necessary? Sighed Maurice, raising his arms.
The guard patted him down thoroughly, then allowed him to join Marissa in the corridor. He moved on to the soldiers, screening and admitting them one by one.
I'm getting tired of this bullshit. Payoff better be worth it, Canada man, or you'll be paying, said Willis as the guard felt down each of his legs.
Once the guard had finished with the three soldiers and Lucy and Lopez, he waved Marissa's guards through before locking the door behind them all. Marissa led the way to the furthest apartment. She delivered another coded knock, but it was lost against the blaring music. She tried again, then pounded the door with her palm until a guard let them in. The room was a penthouse suite, decorated with white leather sofas, faux fur carpets, and a chandelier. A nervous-looking father and young daughter sat on the nearest sofas. The father wore a zip-up vest over a grubby sweater. His limited hair sat round his head like a wreath that had slipped. His daughter wore a banana-yellow tracksuit and had her fingers pressed into her ears. Next to her was a furry rainbow pencil case. On the sofa opposite sat two guards dressed in black, both armed with tasers. A DJ stood at the far end of the room, hunched over a double turntable. He bopped along, fussing over the faders and dials with real panache, making no perceptible difference to the sound, but looking busy nonetheless. Over by the far window stood a large desk. Behind it sat a large, besuited woman in her late 50s who was filling out paperwork while gently nodding along to the expletive-riddled beats. She had dark brown skin and thick, frizzy black hair embellished with bronze highlights. She wore skinny jeans, a white blouse, and a navy blue blazer. Lucy assumed this to be the queen. Marissa led the group forwards and announced their presence loudly over the blaring music. The queen ignored them. Marissa signaled to the DJ to lower the volume, which he did, and she repeated her announcement.
Did I tell you to turn the volume down? Said the queen, not bothering to look at the DJ directly, but continuing to write instead.
Ma'am, your guests were, stammered the DJ, but the queen silenced him with a finger.
She took another minute to finish writing, then placed her pen down and looked up, past the new arrivals to the sofa. She beckoned the young girl over to the desk.
Can you read, honey?
Yeah,
said the girl.
Good. Read this out so your daddy can hear, said the queen. You fucking kidding me?
Mumbled Willis, earning him an elbow in the ribs from Adler. The girl stumbled through the contract aloud.
I, Reginald Barrow, agree to the following terms in return for life preserving medication for my daughter, Cynthia. Cynthia Barrow will assist in laundry and textile services for 8 weeks from the commencement of this contract. During this period, I will forgo my usual privileges and will report to the clinician, whom I will assist in his service to the Queen. I agree to undertake all and any duties required by him to fulfill my debt.
Marissa shared a wince with her nearest guard.
Beautifully read, said the queen, patting the girl on the shoulder. Now take this to your daddy, with this pen. All he needs to do is sign it. Then you can get a brand new inhaler right away.
The child grinned and skipped back to her father, who received the paperwork with a tremble.
The clinician?
He stammered, looking imploringly to the queen.
If the terms are too much for your daughter, there's no obligation to sign, Reginald. You're free to walk away, said the queen, sitting back in her chair with her hands clasped.
The man looked at his daughter, and his face fell. He signed the document, then dropped the pen on the coffee table.
Take that to level 5 for stamping, and they'll take it from there, said the queen.
Thank you,
cheered the young girl as she pulled her dad towards the exit excitedly.
Bye, sweetie, waved the queen.
The queen approached the side counter where she took a jug of filtered water and used it to top off a kettle, which she flicked on. She took a mug and saucer from the counter and laid them out, placing a black tea bag inside with the tag draped over the rim. As the kettle gently boiled, she strolled to the window and gazed across the water to Lower Manhattan. Willis let out a series of increasingly conspicuous huffs until after a minute of being silently ignored, he could contain his impatience no longer.
"Yo, lady, you want what we're selling or not? We come a long-ass way to..."
he began. The queen interrupted him with a raised hand. Willis regrouped and continued more aggressively.
"You fucking for real? You basically strip-search us out in the damn snow, then make us stand around while you do some weird hip-hop poetry ritual or whatever that was? Nah, I'm calling it. We're here to sell, or we leaving. So are you here to buy, or what?"
The queen sighed and continued looking across the water.
"It's always such a pity," she said wistfully.
"What's a pity?" sneered Willis.
"You have high hopes for someone. Then you discover they're not a quick learner.
Marissa, tell me, is it proper to speak to one's leader without being invited?"
"No, ma'am, it's disrespectful," said Marissa.
"Indeed.
And what is a leader without respect?"
Marissa hesitated.
"It's not a trick, honey. I know you know the answer," added the queen.
"They're nothing," said Marissa.
"Precisely. Which puts me in a difficult situation, does it not? Either I accept that the newcomer does not respect me, and in doing so condone the erosion of my own leadership, or I gain his respect, and the balance is restored."
The kettle climaxed to a boil and clicked off.
"Guys, would you mind?"
said the queen, addressing Marissa's guards with a modest smile. The pair seized Willis's arms from behind. One kicked his knee, sending him to the ground, while the other twisted Willis's wrist backward, forcing him to cry out. Before the other soldiers could intervene, the guards on the sofa leapt up and trained their tasers on the group, as did Marissa and the DJ. The guards forced Willis over to the kettle. They grabbed his spare hand and slammed it over the spout. Willis yelped in pain as the searing metal scalded his skin. Marissa waltzed over and turned the kettle back on, keeping her finger depressed on the switch. The kettle boiled furiously, spewing steam into Willis's palm. The soldier screamed in agony and begged for it to end. After 8 agonizing seconds, the queen called them off. The soldiers released Willis, and he fell to the ground, clutching his hand, sobbing. Gasping for breath and trying to stifle his sobs with grunts, he rose to his knees and staggered back towards the group. His cheeks were wet, and mucus streamed from his nose. He fell in line behind Brown and Peters next to Lucy, with his head bowed. The queen returned to the kettle and poured herself a cup of tea. She peeled open a pack of UHT soya milk and tipped it in, then stirred.
"I've gotta hand it to my team. I don't know where they keep finding these sachets. I swear I drank Brooklyn Dry months ago," said the queen.
"There's still Manhattan and Queens," chipped Marissa.
"That is good news."
"Marissa, honey, a question for you. A radio's gone missing from the textiles floor. How shall we get it back?"
said the queen.
"Address the whole floor, tell them what's happened, and give them a deadline to find and return it," suggested Marissa.
"What if they miss the deadline?" said the queen.
"Then no one on that floor eats until it's returned," Marissa shrugged.
"Is that the best way?" said the queen.
"I guess it could piss people off," Marissa conceded.
"Why should that matter to us?" pressed the queen.
"Because most of those people are loyal," said Marissa.
"Do they deserve to be punished for someone else's error?" said the queen.
"No, ma'am," frowned Marissa.
"So perhaps an alternative," said the queen.
"We could talk to some of them in private, the reliables, quietly find out who did it, and then punish them publicly,"
Why is that better?
It keeps people on side and sends a message. Could deter other people from doing the same thing?
Asked Marissa. You'd better get started. Talk of the theft will already be spreading. Let's turn that into talk of the consequences. Oh, and take Mr. Beardy Big Mouth here down to medical as you go. The first 10 minutes are so important for burns.
Added the Queen, gesturing to Willis, who remained hunched over in pain.
What about the others? Said Marissa, nodding at the group.
I'll deal with them, said the Queen.
Marissa bowed and took Willis from the room. The Queen added 2 spoonfuls of sugar to her tea and stirred it before clinking the spoon noisily against the sides, setting the spoon down on the counter and addressing the group.
I'm developing her management skills. I've always felt a personal obligation to nurture potential wherever I find it. Marissa's weakness is that she's too keen to impress me. It makes her reach for heavy-handed solutions, and they can cause more problems than they solve, you know? But Marissa's hardworking, and she's loyal. If you're both of those things, you'll thrive here. Which brings me to you, Maurice, does it not? No doubt you'll tell me you worked hard to get back here. But I think we can agree there's a question mark over your loyalty, said the Queen.
She blew across the hot cup and then stared at Maurice while taking a sip.
Well, out with it, she prompted.
Maurice edged forwards, weary of the tasers still being levied at him. He fell to his knees, clasped his hands, and looked up at the Queen.
My Queen, I was a fool to leave you. I planned to return to tell you I was, like, super sorry, but after everything you've done for me, I knew I needed more than an apology. So, I scoured the nation until I found a gift worthy of you, and yesterday, I found them. The first humans who are immune to those horrible alien beast thingies,
said Maurice, rising to his feet and gesturing to Lucy and Lopez with a bow.
Immune how? Said the Queen, eyeing Lucy as the Canadian presented her and Lopez.
The creatures are scared of them, ma'am. I've seen it. They won't attack them or even touch them. It's incredible. They're like human shields,
said the Canadian, circling Lucy like she was a collectible.
That's quite a claim, said the Queen, taking another sip of tea.
Oh, I've seen it in action. I was being attacked by one of those beasts, and the woman put herself between me and it. The way the creature backed out, it was like she was on fire or something. Then him, this guy, he's unreal. The Major fell down a rock face right into this reptile creature's path, and the thing backed away. It literally went around him,
said Maurice, framing Lopez with his hands. The Queen said nothing and continued sipping her tea. Maurice cleared his throat and continued nervously.
Oh, and the woman? She's a scientist, too,
he said, opening Lucy's backpack and pulling out the green paste.
She put this stuff on my hand when I got cut. It stopped the bleeding, like, right away and covered up the scent so the creatures didn't detect us.
He passed the tub to the Queen, who inspected it.
Ungag her, the Queen ordered.
A guard removed Lucy's gag.
What is this?
Said the Queen, waving the tub at Lucy. I don't know. My predecessor made it. But it works like he said, said Lucy, nodding at Maurice.
Bring me whatever else she's got in there, said the Queen, gesturing to Lucy's backpack.
A guard pulled out Lucy and Rangecroft's notebooks and handed them over.
These yours, too?
Said the Queen, flicking through them both. One is, said Lucy.
I see. You can go now.
I'll call for you when I'm ready,
said the Queen, taking a seat at her desk and opening Lucy's diary. She snapped her fingers and the DJ cranked the volume as the guards chaperoned the group out into the hall. Lucy took care not to overbalance as they descended the staircase, her stability hampered by her tied hands. A few floors down, Brown, Adler, and Peters were separated from Lucy and Lopez and taken away onto that level. Lucy and Lopez were escorted down two more floors, then shown into a level filled with glass office cubicles. The guard slid a nearby cubicle open and moved Lucy inside, but blocked Lopez, who was still gagged, from entering. The guard cut the cords binding Lucy's hands, then slid the glass door shut and locked her inside. Lopez was led away around the corner and out of sight. Lucy glanced around the rest of the floor. The other cubicles were filled with people of different ages, laboring. Some were stripping electrical cables. Others were stuffing rags into cushions. Others were charting a route across a map of the city. She re-examined her own cubicle. It was around 5 yards wide and 8 yards long. Wooden desks lined each glass wall in a U-shape. Upon them sat Macs and keyboards and various charging ports. In the corner was a bucket of water, a sponge, and an empty bucket. In the middle of the floor, a makeshift bed of sofa cushions and a sleeping bag had been laid out. Next to it lay a towel and fresh nightclothes. The office had no blinds, but the lower half of the glass was frosted, so Lucy knelt down and stripped. She gave herself a brisk clean with the cold water, wincing as she pressed the tender, bruised parts of her shoulder where Peters had tackled her in the forest. Below the bruising, she noticed blotches on her upper arm. She checked the other arm. They were there, too. The skin looked dry and irritated and had a reddish tinge. She dried herself off, changed into the night clothes, and crawled into the sleeping bag. As she closed her bloodshot eyes, she couldn't help but picture Jackson's crumpled body. She had been kind to Lucy in the end. She had deserved better.
Lucy! Dan cried. His voice echoed around the trees.
Lucy ran, barefooted, through the dark forest, searching for the source. She opened her mouth to call his name, but no sound came out. The tangled canopy rippled above, drip-feeding dim moonlight across the leaves. The branches creaked in the wind.
"Lucy, please!"
he called, a tone of panic in his voice. Lucy turned and ran towards his voice. Her foot struck something hard and she fell to the floor, landing hard on her ribs. She swept the leaves aside, revealing the train tracks beneath.
"Lucy!"
he cried. The lock turned, snapping Lucy out of her dream. Marissa stood in the threshold.
"Get dressed. The queen wants to talk to you," she said, staring at Lucy impatiently.
Lucy clambered to her feet.
"About what?"
she said, faintly registering that night had fallen outside.
"Just hurry up, or you'll be going like that," said Marissa.
Lucy turned her back to the woman and quickly changed into her uniform and boots.
"What's that all over your arms?"
said Marissa, eyeing up the red lesions.
"You never seen eczema before?"
said Lucy, hastily pulling her top half on. Marissa grunted. They exited the glass cubicle, and Marissa led Lucy back upstairs to the top floor, taking her through security again before they entered the queen's apartment, where Lopez was already waiting.
"Ah, here she is, the woman of the hour. You've had quite the time, haven't you?"
said the queen, waving her notebook at her. Lucy stared at the notebook despondently.
"Did you get some rest?"
said the queen, setting it down on her desk.
"A little," said Lucy. "You'll need your energy tonight, Lucy. I'm giving you the opportunity to prove yourself. Maurice has claimed you're special, immune even, and I need to know how much truth is in that. So tonight, you will be Marissa's bodyguard. She has something important to retrieve from the city, and you're going to make sure she gets back alive. If you're successful, Marissa will launch a flare by dawn," said the queen.
"Will we get weapons?" said Lucy, glancing at Lopez.
"Lucy, you are the weapon," said the queen.
"I'm not. It doesn't work like that. It depends on the creature," urged Lucy.
"Marissa will be armed in case you try anything," said the queen.
"What about the major?" asked Lucy.
"Major Lopez will not be joining you. He's my insurance, honey, in case you feel tempted to flee.
Last I heard, he sacrificed his own escape to stop those brutish soldiers from killing you in some forest. What a sweet guy, said the queen. I did my duty as a soldier, said Lopez.
All right, then you're a sweet soldier. Either way, dear Lucy here owes you.
Don't worry, Miss Young.
So long as you're back by sunrise, we'll all be fine, said the queen.
And if I fail the mission? Asked Lucy.
If you come back empty-handed, there will be non-lethal consequences for you and the Major. You will each have a chance to earn your citizenship, but there will be a punishment element. The real issue is if you don't come back at all. In that case, I'd have to execute the poor Major, and I'll be honest with you, honey, it would be very slow and very public.
You gotta send a message with these things, agreed Marissa, finishing her rifle checks.
I bid you both good luck.
Best hurry. Only a few hours until sunrise, said the queen.
Marissa led Lucy from the room, and they descended the stairs to the darkened atrium where the bony gatekeeper met them. He escorted them outside and cranked the razor wire wedge open. The night was cold but dry, around 40 degrees Fahrenheit, Lucy reckoned. The moon was a thick, bright crescent, around 2/3 full. Lucy paused in the forecourt and marveled at the density of stars that hung over the blackened-out skyscrapers.
Hey, get a move on, called Marissa, who had finished crawling through the wedge.
Lucy followed, dusting off the snow from her hands and knees as she emerged on the other side and hastened after the woman. Lucy and Marissa slipped through the bus blockade into the deserted street, where Marissa unlocked a parked van. The engine echoed off the empty buildings as Marissa took them across the deserted, snowy streets of Brooklyn. They drove for about 10 minutes, during which time Lucy spotted only one candle.
This is us, said Marissa, parking by an intersection and climbing out.
NYU Lutheran Medical Center, read the sign above the hospital entrance across the way. The street looked as if it had been frozen in time during the bacterial outbreak. Abandoned cars and ambulances clogged the final approach to the hospital. Algae dotted the external walls and windows, and a thin vine hung across the entrance sign.
Why are we at the emergency room? Are we getting medicine? Whispered Lucy.
Please, we took that months ago. We're here for the blood bank, said Marissa, opening the van's rear door and retrieving a crowbar.
But it'll be unusable. The refrigerators will have failed months ago, said Lucy, scanning the street.
The science team said they can make it work. They tend to get what they want, said Marissa, slamming the van door and heading for the entrance. She forced the crowbar between the hospital's sliding doors and levered them apart. She then placed the bar horizontally between them, propping the doors open.
The last team we sent in here didn't make it back, so you'd better be immune or we're both fucked, said Marissa, handing Lucy a flashlight.
She turned the rifle's light on, then ducked under the bar and headed inside the gloomy reception. The floor was covered in patches of frosted plant growth, a mixture of pale blue moss, shrubs, wild grasses, and saplings. Amidst the new growth, abandoned gurneys lay overturned with algae and moss growing on them. A red phone on the side of the wall hung off the hook. Lucy stepped on a badge which crackled underfoot. She flinched, seeing the nurse's ID, and kicked it aside.
This way, said Marissa, illuminating a sign to the blood bank.
Lucy followed her further into the building. As they progressed through the corridors, pockets of wild grass and winter heather appeared. Purple ivy stretched across the walls and ceiling, similar to that which Lucy had seen by the farm. The leaves were serrated and had the texture of a pig's ear, like a piece of tough leather covered in very fine pale hairs. Lucy prodded one of the leaves with the tip of her flashlight. A shiver passed down the length of the ivy. Marissa raised her rifle and backed away. The shiver returned, rippling through the ivy back towards the afflicted leaf. The leaf shuddered and detached. It fell to the ground and shriveled, turning pale lilac. In its place on the ivy, something was wriggling out of the bud. Lucy backed away as a wet, black hornet slithered out of the broken stem and settled on the branch, pruning its glistening body. The hornet shook itself out and unfurled its wings. With a flutter, it took off, hovering unstably as it assessed Lucy and Marissa. Marissa moved to raise her rifle, but Lucy stayed her hand.
"Don't provoke it,"
whispered Lucy. The hornet loomed closer and settled on Marissa's ghost-white neck. The woman's eyes bulged as Lucy restrained her from swatting it. Lucy moved her hand slowly towards the creature, finger and thumb ready to pinch its wings. But as she approached, a flap on the tip of the hornet's tail peeled back, revealing a thick stinger. As the hornet raised its tail, preparing to strike Marissa's neck, they were bathed in pale blue light. The strip light above them had flickered on. It was covered in moss, which glowed pastel blue as the light shone through it, the brightness ebbing and flowing in a distinctive oscillation. The hornet retracted its stinger and took off, zigzagging upwards until it landed on the moss. The hornet pruned its wings once again, and the light faded out completely. The hornet buzzed loudly, and Marissa shone her rifle light on the ceiling, but the insect couldn't move. Its feet had become stuck in the blue moss.
"Next time, don't touch the ivy.
This way," said Marissa, pressing on down the overgrown corridor towards the stairwell. As they crossed the doorway, the temperature changed. The air became humid, and there was a putrid, sweet scent of fermenting manure. Droplets of water from the stairs above fell onto Lucy's head and shoulders. By the sounds of it, water was dripping from the stairs below, too, into a pool of sorts. The windows were steamed up. Marissa loosened her jumpsuit as they descended the steps towards the blood bank. The dripping noises grew louder. Spiraling ivy lined their route, the leaves of which darkened with each floor they descended, gradually turning from purple to midnight blue. As they reached the basement, they halted on the staircase. The entire level was submerged. Water lapped at the upper steps, barely a foot from the ceiling.
"Burst water main?"
said Lucy, casting her light down the steps at the submerged doorway. She marveled at the steam rising from the water's surface. Water droplets fell from the ivy onto the black water below, where the plant's roots disappeared. Jade-colored reeds protruded above the surface and arched over themselves as they brushed against the ceiling. Among the reeds grew lily pads. They were violet-colored, shaped like a half bowl, and stuck to the walls. A bristly green stamen arched over each bowl, akin to a hovering chopstick.
"How come it's warm?"
said Marissa, casting her light across the dripping plant life.
"My money's on thermogenic plants. In Wisconsin, there were these skunk cabbages which used to melt the snow so they could pollinate. Maybe these plants have appropriated some of those genes," said Lucy.
"Luckily for you, they've turned it into a sauna," said Marissa.
"What?
You're going in there?
You can't be serious.
Look, the blood bank's down there, and I'm sure as hell not going in. You're the immune one."
Lucy stared at the misting black water.
"This is insane," she said, shuddering.
"Going back to the queen empty-handed would be insane. This is better, trust me."
Lucy picked up a defunct pager from the stairs and tossed it into the water. She and Marissa trained their lights on the ripples. The waves radiated outwards and lapped against the walls until they dissipated entirely.
"Where's the blood bank?" said Lucy.
How would I know? Read the signs," said Marissa.
"In the dark," said Lucy.
"Your flashlight's water resistant," said Marissa.
"My clothes aren't," said Lucy.
"I guess that's a fair point.
Let's check the staff changing rooms. Someone in the place will have a swimming costume. I guarantee it. It's a hospital. They're all health nerds," said Marissa.
"Surely we could just look for blood someplace else. Another hospital, perhaps?"
said Lucy, as Marissa led them up a level and into the frosty corridor. "No time," said Marissa.
"But,"
began Lucy. Marissa cut her off.
"This is non-negotiable, so get over it. Either we get you some gear, or you go in like that and freeze when you come out.
I really don't give a fuck," said Marissa.
They weaved between empty trolleys and beds, taking care not to disturb the ivy as they searched for the staff area.
"Here,"
said Marissa, crossing behind a reception desk and through the private doorway, revealing men's and women's changing rooms. They entered the female section and set about searching the lockers, most of which were locked. "You got anything?" said Marissa, rifling through the few bags on the benches. "Not really," said Lucy, inspecting a gym bag full of running kit. Marissa appeared over her shoulder. "That'll do," she said, grabbing the bag and leaving the room. "What about my eyes and my hair?" protested Lucy, hurrying to keep up as Marissa swung into the men's locker room. "Way ahead of you," said Marissa, poking around the discarded items. "Aha! Seek and you shall find," she cheered, tossing Lucy a bag containing goggles, trunks, and a second towel.
"Oh, and grab some empty bags. We'll need to transport the blood and something," added Marissa as she shook out a couple of backpacks and slung them over her shoulder.
"How much blood are we taking?" said Lucy.
"As much as we can get. Now come on, clock's ticking," said Marissa, grabbing a third bag and heading for the exit.
They returned to the basement level where Lucy stripped. Goosebumps faded from her skin as her body relaxed in the humid air. "You always had it?" said Marissa, staring at Lucy's back as she changed.
"Had what?" said Lucy, pulling on the male swim trunks.
"Eczema," said Marissa, tilting her head. Lucy craned her neck and examined the base of her spine, where a band of red lesions spanned both hips.
"Oh, yeah, it flares up sometimes," she muttered, hastily pulling the running top over her head. "I think blood's down the corridor on the right," said Marissa, squatting and examining the sign above the basement doorway.
Lucy pulled the rubbery swimming cap over her hair. She wrestled it down until it pinged into place across her forehead.
"Tie this around your waist," said Marissa, pulling a fire hose from the wall.
"For real?" said Lucy. "Give 3 sharp tugs on it if you get in trouble, and I'll haul you in," said Marissa. Lucy tied the red hose around her waist as best she could. The nozzle poked up off the end, awkwardly pressing into her abdomen. Lucy picked up her flashlight and slung 3 empty backpacks over her shoulder. She descended down onto the first submerged step, allowing the water to engulf her feet and ankles. It was warm, inviting almost, save for the darkness and the plant life. Lucy pulled the goggles over her eyes and waded down up to her waist, then cast off from the steps and swam towards the door.
"I can't find the handle," Lucy called to Marissa, who was covering her with the rifle.
"You gotta swim for it. Suck it up. We don't have all night," said Marissa. Lucy took a deep breath and ducked below the surface. She squeezed the air pockets out of the empty bags, which dragged in the water. The green reeds stretched to the floor, which was around 2 meters below the surface. Lucy transferred her flashlight into her bag-holding arm and pulled the door open, then swam through into the submerged corridor. The trunk of the ivy stretched along the length of the wall in both directions, where it regularly branched off into a vertical root structure, much like a mangrove tree. Its leaves were gone, but the thick midnight blue trunks were studded with tiny white flowers. The base of each trunk ended in a large tubular bucket. Each trunk bucket had a waxy-looking lid. The majority were lifted like toilet seats. They appeared hollow and glowed violet as Lucy illuminated each one in turn until she reached the first with a closed lid. The flashlight revealed a small curled mass contained within the bucket, which briefly belched out a gas bubble, causing the lid to flap open a few inches. Lucy swam over to the bucket and treaded water. It belched again, and the lid lifted up. She glimpsed inside, a dead rat wrapped in fine violet tentacles. Lucy swam to the surface and took a gasp of air. The blood bank was down the corridor and to the right, as Marissa had said. She swam forwards, but after several more meters felt a jolt across her waist. She'd reached the extent of the fire hose. Spotting a trolley below, she swam down and retied the hose around its metal handlebar before continuing onwards, untethered. She turned the door handle to the blood bank and swam into the room. Tall refrigerators lined the walls. Charts and packing boxes were scattered across the worktops and floor. Lucy pulled open the nearest fridge. With the flashlight tucked under her arm, she stuffed bags of crimson blood into a backpack. It became heavy quickly. She zipped it up and let it sink onto a worktop in the center of the room, then surfaced to catch her breath. Bubbles breached the surface from the far side of the room as another plant trunk discharged its gases. Lucy dived down and filled the second and third backpacks from the next fridges, then left the room. As she swam back towards the main corridor, a clicking sound pricked her ears.
She turned mid-water. Her flashlight reached down the length of the corridor, illuminating the reeds and ivy trunks within. The clicking sounded again. She swiveled around and shone her light in the other direction. The double door at the far end was swinging shut. She kicked away, and more clicks ensued as a pale creature slithered out from the far thicket of reeds. Its body was long and moved like an eel's. It seemed impervious to her flashlight as it slowly snaked towards her. The anemic creature was easily as long as her. A ridge of fins lined the second half of its tail, which tapered to a point. As Lucy swam harder, the creature clicked louder and sped up. She stopped immediately and waited, suspended in the water, as the creature approached. A trunk halfway along the corridor let out an almighty belch, and the creature swiveled around, darting towards the source. Lucy seized the opportunity and made a dash for the trolley. She slung the backpacks onto the trolley and tugged the hose sharply 3 times. The hose tautened, and the trolley began to wheel towards the double doors. The clicking sound resumed in the distance, getting louder as it approached the intersection. Lucy spun around, training the flashlight on the junction as the clicking grew louder, trying to kick backwards as she watched. With a clang, the trolley collided with the door frame behind her. The clicking erupted into a near drum roll as the creature sped towards the commotion. Lucy frantically paddled towards the door and pushed it open, straightening the trolley up for Marissa to reel it in. She glanced down the corridor. The creature was swimming towards her with speed. Lucy grabbed her flashlight and hurled it towards the far end of the corridor like a frisbee. It struck the hanging metal sign with a clatter and dropped into the water below with a splash. The clicking creature spun around and ferreted towards the clatter as Lucy slipped through the doorway to the stairwell. Lucy splashed out of the water and into the steps, startling Marissa, who had hoisted the trolley up the first few steps and was retrieving the backpacks.
"Get away from the water!"
cried Lucy, scrambling up into the flat mid-story platform on the staircase. Marissa grabbed the bags and leapt backwards from the water, letting the trolley slip back down with a bump. She grabbed her rifle and trained it on the black, misting water and the basement doorway.
"Hurry up, get changed," she ordered.
Lucy dried herself hastily, stripping and scrubbing the water away, wincing as the towel rubbed the bruises and lesions on her malnourished body. A loud clicking echoed through the water and the basement door flapped open. Marissa backed away further from the water's edge. An anemic, veiny, webbed paw slapped out onto the first step above the waterline. Marissa fired at it, tearing the paw in two. The creature's limb retracted as a cloudy, milky liquid floated to the surface. She stared at the black water, waiting for the ripples to settle. A second paw slapped onto the step, and Marissa fired again. Lucy grabbed her clothes and raced up to the next level, where she hastily pulled her uniform back on. Marissa followed, clutching the blood bags and covering the stairs below. They stumbled along the corridor to the nearest desk island, where Marissa paused.
"Sling these two on, I'll take the third,"
said Marissa, lowering her rifle and handing Lucy two of the backpacks.
"Freeze!"
cried a voice from the darkness. Lucy squinted as a flashlight dazzled them.
"Shit,"
muttered Marissa, raising one arm in surrender.
"Don't,"
came another voice from the side, catching Marissa stealthily reach for her trigger.
"Toss it,"
demanded the man ahead. Marissa reluctantly slid her rifle across the floor, shunting it a token few feet towards the men. She raised both hands, and Lucy copied. Behind the flashlights, Lucy could just make out two men up ahead and one to their side. The men appeared to have handguns and looked like civilians.
"What's in the bags?" called the man ahead of them. "Blood," said Marissa.
"For real?"
said the man.
"Yep,"
said Marissa. She slowly unzipped her backpack and tilted it towards them. The men shone the spotlights on the blood bags.
"What you doing with 3 backpacks full of blood?"
said the man.
"Fuck you, that's what,"
said Marissa.
"I reckon we want them bags. Toss them over,"
said the man.
"Not gonna happen," said Marissa.
"Toss them or we shoot.
You shoot us and there's blood everywhere. Then the creatures come."
"We'll be gone by then. It's you they'll find," said the man.
"So then what's the point? If all that happens here is you kill us, that seems a waste of your resources. You got infinite ammo?"
"We got plenty of ammo," said the man.
"Uh-huh, sounds that way," said Marissa.
"Lie down on the ground," said the man.
"Fuck you."
The man to their side edged closer, his light growing brighter.
"You want me to take on, boss?"
"Yeah, but the bitch is right. Save your ammo,"
We'll take them old school, said the man, closing in. Lucy swiped her hand across the ivy, showering the floor in withering violet leaves. She grabbed Marissa's arm, and the pair turned and ran. Moss-covered strip lights flickered on overhead, filling the corridor with blue illumination as the men chased after them. What the hell? Cried one of the men as the sound of buzzing hornets filled the air. The men's shouts of confusion turned to shouts of pain as the hornets attacked. They fired hopelessly at the nimble insects, further antagonizing the swarm. Lucy and Marissa sped down the corridor, aided by moonlight reaching through the windows until they reached a fire exit. Lucy kicked it open and they clambered down the metal staircase, jumping onto the snow below. This way, urged Marissa, sprinting towards their van across the street. She whacked on the ignition and hauled the vehicle around as gunshots rang out from the emergency exit. They sped away out of view of the hospital and out of the gunner's range.
Wait, where are you taking us? Said Lucy as they diverged from their original route.
We've got one more stop to make, said Marissa, accelerating. Marissa brought the van to a halt outside an imposing stone building. Appellate Division, Supreme Court of the State of New York, Second Department. The inscription was writ large across the top of the building, spanning its entire width. Slender, moon-made shadows clung to the pillars, framing the entrance, accentuating its height. Marissa grabbed a spare flashlight and jumped out, drawing her handgun as she marched up the stone. Lucy stuck close by her as she pushed through two consecutive sets of metal and glass doors. The golden doorframes matched the gilded lettering across the glass, which reiterated the building's purpose. Marissa struck her handgun against the frame of the metal detector with a clang as she swaggered through. The building was pitch black inside, save for the light from Marissa's flashlight, which jerked unevenly as she marched. As they rounded the corridor, the light fell across fresh moss, which was growing along the skirting boards. Feeding off of it were three tortoises with beige-green shells. The sight of the reptiles startled Marissa, who fired her pistol, killing the first outright. Shit, she cursed, freezing and assessing the other creatures' reactions. While the remaining tortoises seemed indifferent to the loss of their comrade, several roaches scurried out from beneath the baseboards and began feasting on the fresh carcass. Marissa scanned her light across the rest of the hallway, checking for other signs of life, but there were none, save for the moss and algae covering the walls in shades of blue and purple. Come on, said Marissa, pressing on. They reached another golden door with a fresh inscription above it. Courtroom 1. Marissa kicked the door open and stormed in, flashlight and pistol raised. A groan from the front of the room startled Lucy. Marissa trained her light on the upper left-hand side and made a beeline towards the sound. Two figures sat slumped by the front. They were positioned behind the defendant's desk, handcuffed to their seats and to the table legs. Lucy gasped as she saw their uniforms. They were police officers. A rancid smell hit Lucy's nostrils as she approached. The female officer was dead. Her face was pale and emaciated. The carpet by her feet was soaked where the blood had pooled in her legs and burst through the skin. The male cop next to her whimpered as they approached, begging for mercy in a desert dry voice. Officer Priestley, good to see you again, said Marissa, illuminating the terrified man's face.
Please. Just kill me, he stammered.
Like you killed that kid? Come on, that'd be too easy. This is about justice. Surely you figured that out by now, said Marissa.
Help me, begged Priestley, looking past Marissa to Lucy.
Don't listen to him. This man doesn't deserve help, said Marissa.
Why are they here? Said Lucy, pulling her uniform over her nose.
They're awaiting trial. Though it don't look like she's going to be testifying anytime soon, said Marissa, flicking the light at the dead cop.
They're police officers, said Lucy, shocked.
I know, it's disgusting. Someone thought it'd be a good idea to give this scumbag a badge and a gun. He went and killed an unarmed teenage boy last year. There was phone footage of the kid surrendering and everything, hands raised, on his knees, and yet Officer Priestley here still saw fit to shoot him in the back 3 times. Why was that, officer? Priestley whimpered.
Yeah, you know why, said Marissa, holstering her pistol. She knelt down and undid both sets of handcuffs. Priestley slumped to the ground, groaning, while Marissa stood back up.
Case was due to go to court last year, but then the apocalypse happened.
NYPD sensed that the satellites weren't coming back and that the virus was out of control, so they abandoned the city. They retreated into their own enclave, barricading themselves off from everyone, including the National Guard. They hoarded food, weapons, and water and waited for the virus and the creatures to kill the rest of us off. But it didn't get all of us, did it? And now we're the ones running the city, and the cops are scared, because they're running out of food and they know that when spring comes, there'll be a race for the city's remaining resources. So Priestley and his colleague here devised a genius plan to infiltrate our community and map the building so they could take us down before winter ends. He cut his hair. He even dyed it this lovely shade of brown. But our queen recognized him immediately. She found them a couple of uniforms and brought them here to await trial. But there's good news, Priestley. The queen's decided to give you a reprieve, if you help us, said Marissa, tapping the man with her foot. Priestley groaned.
Kill me, he croaked.
Oh, the queen also asked me to inform you that we have your husband, Michael, said Marissa. The cop's eyes widened.
Impossible, he croaked.
Marissa pulled a phone from her pocket and played a short video clip in which an unarmed man delivered a message directly to the camera, addressing Priestley by name and begging him to comply. Priestley wailed with despair. He came looking for you. Sweet, I know. Relax, Priestley, we're not going to hurt him. He's an unarmed civilian, we'd never do that. He wants you back alive, so either you help us, or you're the one hurting him, said Marissa. She played the video again for good measure. Do we have a deal? She added. Priestley nodded, wincing as he rubbed his stiff legs. Here's what's going to happen, child killer. You're going to take us to your little police paradise hideout. We're going to raid your medicine store, which we're reliably informed is on the top floor. You're going to get us in there. If we get this done by dawn, your fella and hers get to live. So we'd best get moving. Lucy, give the good officer a hand, would you? Said Marissa. Lucy helped the officer to his feet. He yelped as his stiff joints stretched out. His breath was awful and his pants stank of urine. He clung to Lucy like a crutch as she followed Marissa out of the courtroom. Marissa gave Priestley a rehydration sachet in the van, followed by a cup of sugary hot coffee from a thermos flask. Technically, this wasn't for you, but I snuck us some extra, said Marissa, handing Lucy a mug of coffee with a wink. She poured herself a cup too, placed it in the cup holder, then hit the ignition. Lucy held Priestley's coffee until it had cooled enough for him to resume drinking without scalding himself. His hands were weak and his movements clumsy.
Kill the car lights, said Priestley after several minutes.
We're still a couple of miles from the hotel, said Marissa.
And they'll see us coming. Kill the lights. Go by the moonlight, insisted Priestley.
They're staying in a hotel, said Lucy.
I know. Cops, right? Said Marissa, killing the lights as she took them deeper into Brooklyn.
Okay, nearly there. Take the next right, said Priestley a while later.
But it's straight on, said Marissa.
They'll hear us. They've got people watching the front. Take the back street, then we can cut through on foot, he insisted.
Marissa took them around to the parallel street and parked outside an auto repair. It had a flat roof, behind which was a tall wire fence, and a little further back from that, a five-story hotel, the tallest building in the neighborhood.
I'm not seeing any cut-through, said Marissa.
It's over the mechanic's roof. Then we climb the fence. It'll take us into the hotel parking lot.
From there, we can access the fire escape. That's the best way to the roof. From there, we can go inside to the top floor and get the medicines. Any other row, and we're guaranteed to get caught, said Priestley. Take one of these, said Marissa, giving Lucy and Priestley a soaking wet backpack each.
What's in it?
Said Priestley. Our get-out-of-jail card to stop them shooting us, said Marissa, swinging on two additional backpacks herself. You should back the van up against the store. It'll give us a way to the roof, said Lucy, eyeing the flat storefront. Marissa obliged, and the three clambered over the trunk, across the van's roof, and onto the flat roof of the garage.
Watch the skylight, hissed Lucy, as Priestley swayed, his balance still weak.
They stumbled across the roof towards the metal fence. Lucy noticed the scratchy felt gripping her boots as she disturbed the layer of snow above it.
Who wants to try this first? Said Marissa. Check the end. There should be a supporting beam we can use as a foothold, said Lucy, edging along to the tip of the fence. She swung around the side pole and gripped the wire mesh with her hands, squeezing a boot tip into the mesh below. Her second foot slipped, causing her to rattle against the wire.
Keep it down, hissed Priestley.
Lucy moved each limb down individually, taking great care until she reached the diagonal support beam propping up the metal pole. From there, she tiptoed down the beam, then jumped the last meter.
Get ready to catch him,
said Marissa, who was helping Priestley around the side of the fence above. He placed a shaky hand onto the mesh, followed by a shaky foot. Gingerly, he lowered himself towards the diagonal beam, only to slip as he tried to transfer his weight. The cop fell 2 meters and landed hard on his back, his fall barely cushioned by the thin layer of snow. Lucy fell on him and stifled his yell with her hands. His pained eyes opened in confusion as he looked up at her imploringly. Marissa quickly caught up, landing quietly beside them. She opened a pocket on her vest and pulled out a syringe.
What's that? Whispered Lucy. Something to help the pain, said Marissa, pulling back the cop's sleeve and threading the needle into his vein.
The cop gasped and sat up panting.
Gah, what's happening? He spluttered.
Shh, keep it down. It's a family recipe. Morphine and adrenaline. I thought you'd be needing it back at the courthouse, but you limped on for quite a while, like the psychopath you are. It'll keep you going so you can help us do this, and we can get you back to your husband. That's the deal, child killer, said Marissa, pulling him to his feet. The cop gathered his thoughts, then led them across the parking lot to the back of the darkened hotel. As quietly as possible, they stacked some empty beer crates beneath the fire escape so they could reach the ladder. They climbed the metal rungs to the first level of the escape, then tiptoed up the remaining flights of steps until they reached the 5th and final floor. The view from the roof reminded Lucy of San Francisco during the curfews. Row upon row of darkened houses with moonlight bouncing off black windows and idle cars, albeit these ones were snow-covered. The eastward night sky was starting to lighten as the first tones of day crept into the horizon. Sunrise was fast approaching.
The medicine's this way, said Priestley, heading towards the roof door.
Change of plans, said Marissa, barring his way.
What do you mean? Said Priestley.
We're staging an intervention. Your husband told us of your planned spring offensive against the Queen, and we can't allow it to happen, said Marissa.
What are you saying? Said Priestley.
Open your backpack, said Marissa. Priestley fumbled the zipper open and lifted out a blood bag.
What the hell?
He said, horrified.
You know what that means, Priestley, said Marissa. This is madness. You call me a psychopath, but you work for a monster.
A monster? She's our savior. She's brought order, shelter, and food to hundreds of starving people when your lot turned their backs on all of us. She's a hero, said Marissa.
In this hotel, there are dozens of people who escaped your queen. The stories they've told are of abuse, violence, and humiliation. What your queen is running is a prison filled with vulnerable people held hostage by fate, said Priestley.
I won't deny we've got hostages. We've got 2, in fact. Your husband and Lucy's sugar daddy. But the other occupants are citizens who can come and go as they please. We protect innocent people, Priestley. I know that's something you struggle to relate to, said Marissa, thrusting a blood pack into Priestley's hands.
Listen to me. This hotel is full of innocent people. If we do what I think you're asking, we're putting all their lives in danger, implored Priestley.
How many people? Said Lucy.
Around 300, said Priestley.
300 cops? Spat Marissa.
Only a quarter of them are cops. The rest are their families and other civilians, said Priestley.
Friends of cops, families of cops, same difference, said Marissa.
I won't do it,
said Priestley, shaking his head. Sure you will, if you want to save your husband, said Marissa. Priestley's eyes began to water with despair. Same goes for you, immune girl. Get pouring, or the major dies at dawn, said Marissa. Lucy stared from Marissa to the backpack to the cop. Marissa drew her pistol, then drew a knife, which she handed to Lucy. She pointed to the AC vents. Cut the bags and toss them down the chutes. That's all you gotta do. Then we fire the flare and go back to the Queen and save your hostages.
And if we refuse? Said Priestley.
If you refuse, I'll do it myself. Then I'll drive back to the Queen without you. I'll tell her you disobeyed her orders, and then it'll be a slow and painful death for your husband and the Major, said Marissa.
You're making us choose one life over hundreds, whimpered Priestley.
You're absolutely right, child killer. It's a choice, said Marissa.
If I do this, my husband lives, said Priestley, staring at the blood pack.
That's what I said, retorted Marissa.
I'll do it. Pass me the packs, said Lucy.
Lucy took the first bag from Priestley's hand and held it over the vent. She stabbed it, then tossed it down the chute where it clattered against the sides and landed somewhere inside the ceiling duct below with a damp thud.
All right, we're officially on the clock, said Marissa.
Lucy stabbed and chucked the bags as quickly as she could, with Priestley feeding them through from each backpack. They spread the payload across vents as Marissa instructed. Within 2 minutes, each backpack had been emptied, and Lucy stood clutching the knife in her bloodied hand.
Good. Now cut him, said Marissa.
What? Said Lucy.
Cut the cop, said Marissa. What the hell's wrong with you? Said Lucy.
Do it, or I'll throw your flare off the side of this building. If the sun starts to rise and there's not been any kind of signal, I don't think the Queen will treat your hostages too kindly, said Marissa.
I'm sorry about this. Hold still, said Lucy, turning to Priestley.
She slashed his cheek with the tip of the blade. She tried to scratch him lightly, but the blade was sharp. Blood seeped from the cut.
All right, we're done here.
Well done, Priestley. I'll tell the Queen you did your job. Your husband's life will be spared. See you back at HQ, said Marissa, heading for the staircase.
You're leaving us? Cried Lucy.
Those creatures are coming, and you're both covered in blood. I'm out of here.
Wait, did I not mention?
This is the second part of your test, Lucy. Get the cop back to the Queen by dawn, or the Major dies. See you round. The flare's in the bag. It buys you an extra 30 minutes, said Marissa, dumping the dry backpack and disappearing down the staircase.
How far are we from the Queen's HQ? Said Lucy, turning to Priestley urgently.
To hell with that. I need to warn my people, replied the bleeding cop.
Hey!
Lucy clamped her hand over his mouth and pinned the knife to his throat.
Shut the hell up. If we get caught, there's no way we'll make it back to the Queen, said Lucy, uncovering the cop's mouth but keeping the blade in position.
Screw the Queen. We need to warn the people in this building.
Yes, but not if it's going to get us caught. If that happens, Lopez dies. Your guy may be safe, but mine isn't, said Lucy.
He's one life. You can't put him above hundreds of innocent people, croaked Priestley.
You damned hypocrite, spat Lucy.
That's different. That was my husband. Who are you saving? Your life partner? A dear friend? Your brother?
No, he's...
He's nothing then, spat Priestley.
He's about the only person left who believes in what this country used to stand for, said Lucy.
I don't buy it, said Priestley.
Fuck you, said Lucy, edging the blade closer.
I'm a cop. I know when people are lying, hissed Priestley.
You really think the Queen's gonna spare your husband if you don't make it back? Said Lucy.
You're changing the subject, said Priestley.
What will I tell him if you're not there? It sounds like he can't bear to live without you, said Lucy.
Concern washed over Priestley's face.
You wouldn't, said Priestley weakly.
I already let my life partner die, and I can't be that person again, insisted Lucy.
The truth at last, said Priestley.
You're still bleeding, said Lucy, pointing to his cheek with the blade. If you want to survive the night, I'm your best bet. I'm immune to the creatures. I can get you to your husband alive, said Lucy.
Let me warn my people first. We're running out of time, implored Priestley.
I can't risk losing you, said Lucy.
Then use the flare. Fire it into the vent. The smoke will lead them to the blood. Do it and I'll come with you, said Priestley.
We're miles from the Queen's place, and it's getting lighter already. I can't throw away 30 minutes, said Lucy.
I can get us a car, said Priestley.
Double-cross me, and you die, said Lucy.
Like you said, I'm bleeding, and my husband's still vulnerable. You're my best bet, said Priestley.
Lucy stared into the man's eyes for a moment, then released her grip. He slumped down the vent and regained his breath. She grabbed the flare and fired it into the nearest AC unit. It smashed against the piping and out of sight.
That should raise the alarm. Now come on, we need to get to the ground before this place is overrun, said Lucy, hastening towards the stairs.
They fled down the exit, rattling down each floor as quickly as they could. As they wound past the third story, a bell sounded loudly inside. The pitch and rhythm varied slightly, suggesting it was handheld. Muffled shouts and cries spread across the building as more residents awoke to the alarm and roused their peers.
Hurry, urged Lucy as Priestley lagged behind.
She finished the final set of stairs, descended the end ladder onto the crates below, and jumped to the ground, regaining her balance in time to catch Priestley as he followed.
That way, cried Priestley, pointing down the side of the hotel.
As the pair skirted the length of the building, Lucy heard an engine running. She stopped at the periphery and stuck her head around the corner. A man was sitting behind the wheel of an SUV, shouting through the open window to people on the street. A child was running from the hotel towards the passenger door. A woman stood on the sidewalk shouting at someone else inside to hurry.
The safe house is too close. We need to get further away from the blood, cried the man.
I'll distract them. You get the kid in the back. She's our leverage.
Go, cried Priestley.
Lucy scampered to the far side of the street, into the shadows, and skulked towards the parked vehicles as Priestley staggered down the sidewalk towards the woman.
Josie, take me with you,
cried Priestley, waving his arms dramatically. Lucy drew level with the rear passenger door.
Oh my God, Leo,
cried Josie as Priestley ran towards her.
He's bleeding, cried the father from the car.
Lucy darted to the car and pulled the rear passenger door open. She hauled the young girl out and pressed the bloodied knife to her neck.
Jesus,
cried the man. Lucy stood in front of the car.
Do what we say and she'll be fine. Now get in the back, shouted Lucy.
The father jumped out of the front seat, his hands raised imploringly.
Please, please let her go, he begged. Get in the back. Priestley, you're driving, yelled Lucy.
Priestley hurried to the driver's seat.
In the back, both of you,
yelled Lucy to the mother who was clutching her remaining child by the shoulders, terrified. More people were beginning to run through the hotel lobby, heading for the street. The mother and daughter hurried into the back of the car. Lucy dragged the quivering hostage child into the front with her, drawing her onto her lap and sealing the door. Priestley slammed the accelerator and pulled them away as confused shouts called after them. Priestley pulled on his seatbelt as he drove. Lucy took note and ordered the child to draw hers over both of them.
What the hell are you doing? Cried the mother from the back.
Saving my husband, said Priestley as he sped through the streets.
Please let my daughter go, begged the husband from the back. She's fine. We're taking you to safety, said Lucy. You're covered in blood. You're a magnet for the creatures, cried the father. Then give me a rag, said Lucy.
The father passed her a towel from the floor. Lucy wiped her hands and knife clean, then tossed the towel out of the window. The tip of the sun was edging onto the winter horizon.
Give me another, said Lucy. I don't have another, said the man. Then make one, said Lucy, discreetly resheathing the knife.
He tore a strip off of his shirt sleeve and passed it to Lucy. She dabbed the excess blood from Priestley's cheek, then tossed it from the window while a new layer formed along the cut.
It was you, wasn't it? The blood in the vents. You did it, cried Josie.
I didn't have a choice,
protested Priestley.
You've condemned them all, said Josie.
We gave them a warning. It's more of a chance than they were ever going to get without us, said Lucy. Lucy spotted two beams of light twirling across the night sky. The top of the Queen's building was lit up like a beacon.
You can't be serious. We're not going back. You can't take us back, protested the father.
You've been here before? Said Lucy, aghast.
Christ, it took us 2 months to escape. She's going to punish us, the man whimpered.
The Queen's building came into view. Refugees welcome was written across the top floor windows in giant iridescent paint. Rap music blared as they approached.
Oh, shit,
cried Priestley as a beast leapt in front of the headlights. He swerved heavily, hitting the curb at speed and flipping the SUV onto its side. It skidded through the snow into a parked vehicle. The collision projected the unbuckled father out of his seat and into the car's roof before he crashed down in a heap by the passenger window to the screams of his wife and daughter. Lucy and the girl hung sideways in the front seat, suspended above Priestley, whose forehead was bleeding. Lucy's eyes widened in horror as the beast reappeared in the van's headlights, bounding towards them. Gunshots rained down in the darkness, and a series of bullets embedded themselves in the beast, felling it in the street. Lucy pushed the passenger door upwards, thrusting it open.
"You're gonna have to climb out. I'm gonna leave the seatbelt in place. You gotta wriggle. See that gearbox there? Put your foot on that. Good. Now, see the doors open. You gotta climb to the edge, then jump down onto the sidewalk. Your mom and sister will be right behind you, I promise. Now go," said Lucy, helping lift the girl up to the door ledge. Placing her own foot on the gearbox, Lucy unclipped her seatbelt. She leaned down and unclipped Priestley's too, then dragged him to his feet. She slapped his face several times and his eyes fluttered open.
"Hey, stay with me, nearly there. I'm gonna climb up, you gotta follow," said Lucy. She hauled herself up to the door ledge, then braced her feet and one hand against the frame. With tremendous effort, she reached down and pulled Priestley upward. He climbed groggily with much coercion until Lucy could reach his belt and drag him up over the lip of the doorway. He slumped over the edge and onto the snowy sidewalk. Lucy jumped down and helped him up.
"Help us, please,"
cried the woman who was still inside the vehicle. Having gotten her second daughter out, she was trying in vain to shift her husband. More gunshots rang out from the surrounding buildings. Lucy climbed into the doorway and reached down, pulling the woman out.
"Get your kids to safety. I'll help your husband," shouted Lucy.
The woman stumbled onto the sidewalk.
"There's a gap between the buses. Get inside the building and take him with you," Lucy ordered, pointing the mother to the dazed Priestley.
Lucy dropped to the ground and forced the SUV trunk open. She clicked the uppermost back seat down and leaned over. The father was coming around, groaning.
"Give me your hand," she called, glancing at the buses as the group weaved between them.
The man reached up feebly. Like Priestley, he was bleeding from the head. Lucy grasped his hand and hauled, but the man screamed out in pain. His shoulder was pinned beneath the broken driver's seat. Lucy tried to shift the seat, but it just caused more pain. Bullets rang out nearby.
"I'm gonna try to lift the seat again. Be ready to move your arm clear. 1, 2, 3, cried Lucy, heaving against the buckled seat rail.
The man cried out in pain, moving no distance at all. Lucy leapt to the ground and tackled the rear passenger seat, pulling it back vigorously until it snapped away, revealing the man's bloodied face. His arm was crushed beneath the seat in front, and Lucy could see no way to free it.
The man reached out, and Lucy clasped his hand in empathy. He looked at her imploringly. "Help me, please. My daughters, help me," cried the man, tears in his eyes.
A roar echoed across the street, followed by a second. Fear washed over Lucy as the two beasts bounded towards her. Her fleeting sense of immunity evaporated as the gnashing creatures tore towards her with intent.
"I'm sorry," she cried.
Lucy released the man's hand and ran for the blockade. As she fled between the buses, she saw bullets fell only one of the creatures. The second leapt into the open trunk. She emerged from the buses and ran across the forecourt to the razor wire edge, which the gaunt gatekeeper had cranked open in anticipation.
"Close it,"
she cried as she crawled through into the HQ side and sprinted for the building. Gasping for breath, she hurtled into the atrium where Marissa was waiting with the escapees.
Where is he?" said the mother, looking at Lucy in disbelief.
"I'm so sorry. He was already gone," said Lucy, swallowing and staring at the floor. The mother collapsed in a fit of grief. The two daughters looked lost beside her. A guard placed a hand on the woman's shoulder and helped her up, taking her to a sofa in the lobby.
"Where's Priestley? He needs green paste," said Lucy breathlessly.
"They're dealing with him," said Marissa.
"And Lopez?" said Lucy.
Marissa bowed her head solemnly.
"We never got the flare signal. He didn't make it. I'm sorry," she said.
Lucy's mouth turned dry and she sagged into a chair, waves of denial crashing over her as the news sank in.
"You did what you could.
Get some rest. It's a fresh day tomorrow, said Marissa.
A guard directed Lucy towards the stairwell. She rose from her seat in a daze and followed his steer, climbing two flights of stairs until they peeled off onto the new level. The guard led her onto a floor with multiple segmented glass offices, similar to the one she'd stayed in previously. Lucy stared at her boots as the guard led her down the corridor. He unlocked a cubicle and nudged Lucy inside. It smelled of urine and gas, but it was warm.
Lucy? Came a familiar voice.
She looked up as Lopez wrapped his arms around her. He checked her for injuries, then guided her to the floor.
You came back,
he said, clasping her by the shoulders with immense gratitude.
You're alive,
Lucy said distantly.
Thanks to you,
said Lopez. Lucy took in their glass cubicle. Three strangers lay asleep on the floor around them.
Are you okay? What did they make you do?
Said Lopez, scratching his arm. Lucy pulled his sleeve back and stared at the red lesions covering his skin.
It's nothing, said Lopez, moving to recover his arm, but Lucy stopped him.
She held up her own arm next to his and pulled her sleeve back.
You've got the same, he whispered, glancing around.
This is like what happened to Jackson, said Lucy.
But we didn't get infected. We only swallowed the powder, said Lopez.
Maybe this is a side effect, said Lucy.
How long do we have?
Jackson got weak quickly, said Lopez. Her condition was complicated. We might have another day, but it's definitely spreading, said Lucy.
Can we get more white powder? Said Lopez.
I tried that with Jackson, and it didn't save her. I think it might be the cause, said Lucy.
Lopez stared at their spreading lesions, a grim look across his face.
We need a cure.
Fast, said the major.